Near FM.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Hi there and welcome along to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph.
And I'm Dave Daly.
Now, to begin with, in a few moments' time, the Nearby Business News Desk with myself and Dave, where we will discuss some of today's business headlines.
In the business of this week, a look back at another business we've visited in the past this week, the business of baking, and my visit to Shauna Quinn in the Middle Child Bakery.
After that, Aoife O'Brien from a company called Happier at Work joins me to tell me of her ambitious objective to make the world a happier place, one workplace at a time.
In our weekly radio column this week, Jenny Tyrrell looks at Dublin-based firm, fintech firm Finergo, who are on a mission to go global.
Yep, indeed they are. And finally then, David Bell from the HR department will be here for a regular look at HR issues. This week, a look at annual leave during the lockdown. Now, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories today, you can contact the show by text while we're on the air to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or indeed, you can get in touch anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
News Desk on Nearby Business.
So, welcome along to the Nearby Business News Desk. Today, Dave, we've a couple of interesting stories. The first one is that the Norwegian insurer who has taken a stake in FBD are claiming it's not a strategic move.
Yeah, shares in listed Irish insurer FBD surged as much as 13% today after the Norwegian insurance group Protector Forsikring revealed it has become one of the largest shareholders in the company after building a 6.3% stake in the firm. But the Norwegian insurance group is not preparing for a bid for the listed Irish insurer and took a 6% stake purely for investment purposes. The Norwegian company's chief investment officer has told the Irish Independent today. Now, Protector Forsikring revealed this morning that it had acquired 6.3% in the company, sending the Irish company shares surging more than 10% as investors bet it might have had a decision on listing on designs on the listed insurer. The investment is not strategic and is taken by the investment department in Protector. That's what the chief investment officer said. His name is Dag Marius, and he said an entrance to the Irish market is not on the agenda, he added. He said that they paid about 7.720 per share for the FBD stake and was happy to have been able to acquire a substantial holding in the business. He said he'd spoken to FBD management before taking the stake and was confident of the company's longer term prospects. And he said, we would like the market position and we'd like the track record of the company, he said. Protector has about $1.5 billion worth of assets under management and the FBD stake represents about 1% of that. He said the company continually assesses investment options and would not rule out acquiring additional shares in FBD.
So yeah,
possibly in the future, yeah.
A good company, a very successful company here in the Irish marketplace, FBD. Under a little bit of pressure, obviously, on the COVID payments. We've talked about that before on the programme where they need to pay up now on the business insurances that people had. So
yeah.
Notwithstanding that, they were well provided for it, apparently. So they're in good shape still. And obviously, the Norwegians spotting that and looking for a good return on their investment. Now, another story you have for us, Dave, is about Brexit, another gift that keeps on giving. And the Brexit effect is still lingering on exports.
Yeah, well, the Brexit effect is still lingering, of course. The value of Irish goods exports to Britain across January and February amounted to just over 1.81 billion, down by nearly 250 million on the same 2 months last year. Brexit is still negatively impacting Ireland's trading relationship with Britain, with new figures showing a 12% year-on-year slump on the value of exports into Britain in the first 2 months of the year. Now, obviously, on the other side, the inbound delays in customs clearance, VAT charges, duty charges, all that kind of stuff are having a massive effect on businesses here too. And I noticed personally myself in my own business, the actual courier business throughout the whole of Europe is upside down at the moment, nearly, but trying to get stuff. It's taken where possibly stuff going to Italy would have taken about a week, 10 days, taken 3 weeks.
Wow.
Parcels are going missing. Stuff is, it's probably because of the land bridge issue not being used, the new routes, all those kind of other issues. So hopefully it will settle down. But the VAT at point of entry and duties, all those kind of things are just, they're not helpful really, to be honest. Yeah. It was never a good idea. I'm still stand firmly
absolutely
behind that.
Yeah, it's just so difficult. I mean, we haven't had to do it for so many years. I mean, we're obviously back to pre-1973 or whenever it was. Ireland continues to be a good bet for debt, and the NTMA have received advanced orders for debt bonds.
Yeah, the NTMA has received about 30 billion of orders from international debt investors for a 20-year bond being sold today. Sources said on Wednesday that the state's debt management agency was now looking to raise between 2 and 3 billion from the debt sale, but there's now a speculation in the market that it may accept orders for 4 billion. The bonds, which are being marketed by a big list of names here, Barclays, BNP, Cantor Fitzgerald, Danske, JP Morgan, Normina for the MTA, are poised to carry out a coupon or interest rate of about 0.55%, apparently. The agency has raised about 7 billion so far this year, selling long-term bonds with its full-year goal set between 16 to 20 billion. I think the debt is around 18 billion from last year, and it's going to be similar this year, and that was announced by Pascal today, just in terms of planning. And he said it'll be take to 2025 before we actually start to balance budgets again.
Right.
This is the first syndicated bond deal, of course, through the banks and security firms that the NTA has carried out since it withdrew its authorisation for Davy to act as primary Irish government bond dealer last month, as the firm was caught up in the bond scandal, which we knew all about. So Ireland is a safe bet, as you said there.
Yeah.
You know, they're queuing up obviously to do it. You know, internationally we will be known as a country with you know, very safe place to do business and a well established and safe democracy, I think the term is what you
absolutely
used earlier.
Yeah, so. I mean it is very much a safe bet.
And we pay our debts.
We honour our commitments and we pay our debts, and that's why we continue to get the investment, because it's very important that we do continue to get the investment, because it does keep the wheels of industry, the wheels of business.
Pays all the pandemic payments and everything else,
everything
that,
like that.
When the taxation is down.
Very important. Yeah, absolutely.
The Business of on Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM.
So, Dave, in the business of this week, we're going to do what we've been doing for the last couple of weeks. We're going to take a look back at another business that we visited in the past. And this week it was your visit to meet Shona Quinn in the Middle Child Bakery.
Yeah, and I actually went back there last Saturday and I had a chat with Shona. We didn't record anything. We just had a little chat around things. And she was covered in flour. She was very busy. And she said her kitchen is getting too small for her. She was
great,
in the middle of her deep clean, as she calls it, which they have to do under the regulations. And I came away with a nice bag of large cookies.
Large bag of cookies. You get all the good jobs. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a listen back to at some of the comments and noises and sounds and smells, if you could get it on the radio, that Dave had when he visited Shona there back a little while ago. So we have a relive that for a couple of moments. Sweet dreams
are made of these. Nearby Business on the road today on this chilly Saturday morning. I'm down here at the Home Farm Football Club in the beautiful catering kitchen, and I'm with Shona. And Shona is the owner of the Middle Child sort of treats and bakery business. Hiya, Shona. Great to be here.
Hi, how are you? Great to have you. Welcome to the kitchen.
Okay, I see some lovely treats here in front of us as I speak to you. Can you tell us a little bit about your business?
Yeah, so I'm doing cookies and treats and all things tasty for a few coffee trucks around the area.
Okay, so I see in front of me here we have some chocolate brownies. Are they brownies? Would they be sponge cakes or brownies with lovely chocolate on the top and white chocolate shards, no doubt?
Yeah, so that is our Belgian chocolate brownie with the chocolate ganache on top and white chocolate, just to add to the chocolatiness.
Okay, there's a lovely smell here of chocolate, and the fan is on, the oven is on here, and you're baking away. You start every morning early. Tell me what time.
I started around 5:30 every morning.
5:30, that's an early start.
Yeah, well, I'm used to it. I've been in the bakery industry for about 10 years now, so I'm very used to getting up early.
Okay, we're going to have a little bit of a look at your process now in a minute, and we're going to step over to the ovens and see what's happening there.
Born free as the wind blows. As free as the grass grows, born free to follow your heart.
Now, we moved over to the area where the mixing goes on. You can probably hear in the background here the mixer going ahead. Now, Shauna's going to just tell us what's on the menu today. What's happening here?
Yeah, so I'm just getting prepped for next week. So I just have my butter and sugar creaming here. So then I'll slowly add in my eggs and then my flour and chocolate chip. And then we'll have our chocolate chip cookie.
Chocolate chip cookies, beautiful. And just in terms of the range that you do, is it sort of sweet treats and things like that generally? Do you do any cakes?
Yeah, so I do some cakes as well. I do novelty cakes for special events or anything like that. So I had two that have already gone out this morning. So that's great. But at the moment, a lot of the stuff I do is cookies, tray bakes. I do some brown bread as well. So it's just growing each day. So at the moment, it's just myself. My mum has come and she helps me do a bit of cleaning every so often when I have to do my deep clean. But it all came about. I suppose I lost my job. I took the leap before. Just before lockdown happened, and I had moved into the events industry. I had been working for 2 weeks in my job, and unfortunately the events industry went under. So I spent 4 months volunteering for Feed the Heroes campaign, and then in that time I was kind of just thought, why don't I take this leap, and here I am.
So you did, social media is a big part of this. So obviously it's for a budget that you can do a certain amount. Do you do any placement and ads on those yet, or are you just looking at putting out to just your friends and followers?
Just my friends and followers at the moment. I did home ec from first to third year, and then I chose geography instead of it for my leaving cert.
That maybe accounts for the fact that you may have travelled across the world to New York and this was up.
Maybe, but I suppose cakes has always been something I've been really interested in. Any of my friends will tell you from most of their birthdays, and they've always just gotten a cake from me, and
You mentioned your mum there. Would she have had an influence on you? Would your mum be a baker?
Absolutely. My mum's an incredible cook. Yeah. So she definitely would have had an influence, and she's great. She always let us do what we wanted and try out everything. So,
yeah. Just on the business side of things, how do you find the world of business in terms of buying products, paying your invoices, getting paid? And do you have a little system, a time of the day or a particular time of the week that you do that kind of thing, just for other small businesses out there?
Yeah, so Monday would be my quietest day. So I try to do all of my
admin
work on a Monday. I've been very lucky that I have been in the industry for 10 years now, that I do know suppliers, I do know reps, that side of it was all very easy for me to fit into my own small business because I had the contacts. But all of the companies are great if you just ring them to get in touch and bring out samples of what you may need. But Monday will be my admin day to get everything. And there's brilliant systems out there that can help you put it all together very easily.
Yeah, I think that might look like it's done. I don't know. I'm just looking at it.
Oh,
here.
Yeah. Well, you can never go too creamed with your butter and sugar because it makes for a nicer cookie the longer.
So what happens to that next? So you put that on a tray next, and then the oven is ready to go and you cook for a period of time?
No, so there's a bit of a process. Okay. So I will weigh all this out into my specific weights that I need for each cookie, and then it will go into the fridge and they'll sit for 24 hours, and then I'll take them out the following day and then I'll bake them.
Okay, now, what's the future hold for this business, do you hope?
I would love to have my own little bakery cafe.
Lovely.
Yeah, that would be the dream. That's always been the dream. So here we go. It's started now. So fingers crossed for the future. So
Shauna from the Middle Child Bakery, thank you for talking to us this morning. And the smell here is absolutely gorgeous. Thanks again.
Thanks a million.
Who stole that cookie from that cookie jar?
Well, who stole the cookie from the cookie jar? Number one stole the cookie from the cookie jar. Who me stole the cookie from the cookie jar? Yes, you stole the cookie from the cookie jar.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt about it. Dave Daly gets all the good gigs here. And that was us reminiscing of David's visit to Shauna Quinn, to meet Shauna in her bakery, in the Middle Child Bakery. And as he said, it's going really, really well for her. And we wish her the best of luck.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
I'm joined now by Aoife O'Brien from Happier at Work. Aoife, how are you?
Thanks so much, Declan. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. I suppose the first thing to say is, what a fantastic name for a business.
Thank you. Thanks. I want to take all the credit for this? But I suppose it does, for me, it does what it says on the tin. So why not?
Yeah, exactly. And I know you've been in related type businesses for some time. So even though Happier at Work is a relatively new venture, maybe just tell us a little bit about your background and how you've come to end up owning and operating and running here Happier at Work.
Absolutely. So, well, my background is actually quite different, you might say. So I worked in market research for a long time. I worked here in Dublin. I worked in London and Perth and Sydney in data analytics, analysing human behaviour, what people actually do in supermarkets, of all things. And I had a couple of work experiences that kind of prompted me to have a think about how to create happier workplaces, essentially, as I know it now. At the time, I probably wasn't thinking along those lines, but I thought, as an individual, how can I make a better decision around my career? And as an organization, how can the companies choose better people? How can they create better work environments to retain staff for longer? And so I've been thinking about that idea probably for about 10 years. And so when I first started in business, I was looking more at the individual side of things through coaching. And as the business evolved, I thought, where can I add more value? And really, it's around the analytics piece and working with organizations to use analytics to create happier workplaces and deal with issues around culture and staff retention, particularly.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that. I mean, how do you use data to drive happier work environments and to get that analysis done? What, I mean, without obviously letting out all your secrets, I mean, what type of data are you looking at? Maybe give us some feel for that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's lots of different ways that you can use data in an organizational setting. So oftentimes companies have at their disposal quite a lot of data on their people already through the HR systems and things like that. So that's kind of a place to start, would be to have a look at what you have and maybe where you need to plug the gaps. My particular area of expertise in this creating happier workplaces is based on research. And so it's not, you know, oftentimes we think about happiness at work and we think, oh, it's a little bit fluffy maybe. But I like to use that evidence-based research around particular things like looking at values. So what are the values of the organization versus the values of the individual in the organization or individuals that you're looking to bring into the organization? Another element would be around needs and how needs are being satisfied at work and whether they're being satisfied or are they being thwarted by policies and procedures and things like that. And then the third element is around strengths and abilities of the team to be able to perform the role. And are they able to perform at their fullest potential, essentially? So they're kind of, just to give it a snapshot of three of the different areas that I particularly will look at and be able to measure those types of things within an organization.
And you know the old saying that culture eats strategy. Where does that fit into to all the thinking? And you're talking there about, you know, aligning people's ideas and people's culture and people's thoughts with the company's objectives and the company's strategy.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it really is all about culture. But then you might say, look, what is culture? Culture is really the behaviors of the people and it's how decisions get made. And it's a collection of people as opposed to the company itself having that culture. It's the people in the company and it tends to come from the top. So being really clear about what your values are at that top and how decisions get made. So if you have a value of fairness and equality, for example, that you're making decisions in a clear and transparent way and that they are seen to be fair and equal, you know, that everyone has that visibility on how decisions are actually getting made.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? I said in the start of the interview that you've set up Happier at Work in 2019, very recently, and you have a fantastic objective, which is to make the world a happier place, one workplace at a time. How are you getting on?
Well, this is it. I'm doing it one workplace at a time. And it's funny, when I first set up my business, as I mentioned, it was all about the individual side of things. I had an idea that I wanted to do consulting as well. But when I first started, I was very much focused on coaching individuals, particularly around their careers. And it's really only in 2020 and with the pandemic that I saw an opportunity to really focus on organizations and be able to branch out into that side of things. In terms of how it's going, I mean, when I say one at a time, it's kind of like, how do I reach more at a time? And, you know, I do have the podcast as well as a way to reach a wider audience. So, yeah, I mean, one at a time feels kind of in some ways a little bit small at the moment as well. So it's like, how do I would love to get a sense of kind of world domination eventually. But yeah, at the moment, it is going one at a time.
Yeah, but I mean, that's how things start, isn't it? One by one,
exactly,
you know, and ultimately it builds up to a very large number. And you mentioned a podcast there, which is also called Happier at Work. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because the podcast sort of came before the name of the Happier at Work business. I started the podcast in August 2019, again, probably without a really clear vision of exactly what it was I wanted to achieve. But as things have evolved, it's very much focused on four specific areas within creating happier workplaces. So that would be focusing on leadership, diversity and inclusion, well-being at work and the future of work. And all of those different areas are really, really important at the moment. And especially in light of COVID, this concept of the future of work and what that might actually look like, you know, is it going to be a hybrid working model? Is it going to be most people are working remotely? What does that actually look like? And so the podcast has been running at this stage for over a year and a half, over 18 months. I just hit a milestone there at the weekend, 20,000 listens. So I'm absolutely delighted with how it's going. It's primarily interview based and I love having the conversations. It's not scripted in any way. I invite someone on, we have a conversation and I just get into it and I really, really enjoy having that conversation. And I tend to make it as practical as possible. So towards the end of the podcast, I'll do a summary of some of the key points that were made during the podcast, just so people have some clear takeaways and some clear actions to take from it. Yeah, so that's kind of how it's going. And it's evolved over time. As I mentioned, it's interview based, but I am looking to start doing some solo episodes. So typically it's around 45 to 50 minutes each episode, but the solo ones will be maybe 5 to 10 minutes, bite-sized type of stuff with just me on them.
Yeah, great. No, and I mean, you cover, looking back at some of the more recent ones there, you cover some really interesting and relevant topics as well. I mean, it. You mentioned there, obviously, the difficulty with people working remotely during COVID and perhaps, you know, what does the future of the workplace look like? But one you did there recently on mental well-being and you know, lifestyle and awareness and all of that. These are things that you know, people do make people either happier at work or not happier at work, maybe even perhaps.
Well, this is it. And for me, it's about giving, whether it's individuals or whether it's managers or whether it's leaders in organizations, giving them the tools that they need to create that happier work environment by having these discussions and maybe challenging how they're currently doing things or how they're currently thinking about things.
Yeah, yeah, it is a changed landscape, of course. And what would be your own view, Aoife, about what the future will hold? Will it be a hybrid sort of situation we find ourselves in?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting conversations I had actually in the summer of last year was with a man called Andrew Barnes, and he's a huge proponent for this 4-day week. And actually, I was just thinking, I wasn't intentionally going to talk about the 4-day week, but more around this idea of flexibility. And one of the ideas that he had was that people probably do their best work when they're on their own. So in the home environment with reduced distractions, you know, obviously at the moment, or maybe not so much now, but previously when kids were still at home and, you know, things were a little bit more distracted. But that when you bring people together, then it's for collaborative work and it's for socializing. So the office would be more focused around collaboration and socializing, but actually your best work might get done at home. So I thought that was a very interesting idea that he had in terms of the future. And I think it's certainly going to be a hybrid environment with lots and lots of global organizations, particularly offering this kind of hybrid work environment where, you can opt whether or not you want to come into the office, you know. And I think that's giving people the option is really good. But I suppose the question still remains about how to manage that. And it's not so much the logistics as the visibility that you get from being in the office. So if you're in the office and one of the senior leaders is in the office, then they get to see you more. And so you more easily come to mind when it comes to things like projects and promotions. And it's about how to manage that when people are working remotely or they're working on different, I was going to say shifts, but I kind of mean if they're not in the office at the same time, essentially. So if you're working Mondays and Tuesdays at home and you're in the office Wednesday and Thursday, but that's not the same day as the leader, for example, then you're not getting that same level of visibility as you might otherwise do.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And you mentioned the four-day week. Apparently, from some research I've done, the five-day week came out of the Spanish flu time. After that, people realised they shouldn't be working 7 days a week, so they decided to work 5 days. So maybe the four-day week will come out of this pandemic. Who knows?
Yeah. And I'm connected with Andrew on LinkedIn, and I see him posting an awful lot of stuff where companies are at least trialing it. And the idea being, it's not 4 days for reduced pay. It's 4 days at full pay with the view that if you work in a more concentrated effort, so like if you work 8 hours over 4 days instead of 8 hours a day for 5 days, that you get more work done and your productivity actually increases because you're more focused on what it is that you need to get done in that time. And in the remaining time, in the day off that you have, whatever day of the week that might be, that's the time then that you can do all those other chores that might get in the way of being able to effectively work. So, you know, that could be checking social media, could be booking holidays whenever we can or whenever we could book holidays. And it could be all that other kind of life admin stuff that goes with that, kind of can creep into the working day as well.
Sure. Yeah. Aoife, it's a fascinating company that you have. The podcasts sound really interesting as well. And thanks a million for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to me this evening on Nearby Business. And I wish you luck making the world a happier place, one workplace at a time.
Thank you so much, Declan. It's been a pleasure chatting to you today.
Thanks. That's Aoife O'Brien there from Happier at Work.
Coming up in the second half of Nearby Business, our weekly radio columnist Jenny Tyrrell will be here, and this evening she looks at the Dublin-based fintech firm Finergo, who are on a mission to go global. After that, David Bell will be here from the HR department for our regular look at HR issues. This week, a look at annual leave during lockdown. And Dave has a tale of two cakes as well. All of that to come on Nearby Business.
90.3. This is Near FM.
And welcome back to Nearby Business. And don't forget, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can contact the show by text while we are on the air to 087-6944-500 or anytime on Twitter at nearby_business, #localbiz. Now, in our weekly radio column this week, Jenny Tyrrell looks at Dublin-based fintech firm Finergo, who are on a mission to go global.
Taking care of business on Nearby Business.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Irish fintech and regtech company Finergo is set to create 100 new jobs in Dublin by the end of 2021, which will bring its total headcount locally to 500 and to 950 across the group. Dublin headquartered in East Point Business Park, with a further 14 offices globally, its new hires will span across professional services, engineering, finance, regulation, customer success, HR and sales. Among the openings will be 5 graduate technology roles and 10 vacancies in cloud security and SaaS engineering. Finergo provides software for investment, corporate and private banks to help them manage regulatory onboarding and entity data management processes. Its 300 clients are based across North America, EMEA and Asia Pacific regions and include State Street, Danske Bank, NatWest, BNP Paribas, Aviva and PricewaterhouseCoopers. 32 of the top 50 banks in the world currently use the Finergo platform. Finergo was set up in 2008 by Mark Murphy, a DCU graduate, born and bred in Finglas, with a mission to target financial institutions as its customers. Mark initially worked as a software engineer before he ended up joining Ergo via a placement at IBM. A software engineer with over 20 years' experience developing and delivering enterprise software for banks, he then used these core skills to build and grow Finergo into the leading-edge financial technology company it is today. At the same time, Mark had just remortgaged his home, had convinced his father to do the same, and talked his uncle and others into investing money into his new enterprise. Just weeks later, Lehman Brothers collapsed, prompting a meltdown in global financial markets. But more than a decade on, though, their faith in Murphy's business idea is being repaid. Mark never saw himself as an entrepreneur, in spite of this clearly being ingrained in his family's DNA. His uncle, John Purdy, is a former Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year category award winner in 2014, whose IT services company Ergo started out as a two-man firm selling toner cartridges for printers in 1993. Ergo has pioneered IT services in Ireland over the past 25 years and now employs more than 400 people with annual revenues of 100 million euro. Another close family member, his aunt Barbara Carney, is managing director of the Irish transport and logistics company BCS Express. 2020 was another fantastic year for growth for him and his team. He said financial institutions globally are fast-tracking the switch to digital and are keen to reap the benefits of cloud, a technology previously regarded by the industry with caution. In response to market needs, Murphy added that Finergo is now on the lookout for experts in engineering and product who will be vital in driving the company's cloud strategy. His mission is to build a big global fintech out of Dublin. Ireland is now a hotbed of technology talent, and we are committed to creating an attractive working environment that fosters career development and technological innovation, he said. Last year, Finergo raised $80 million in funding from ABN AMRO Ventures and DXC Technology, and was named Technology Ireland Company of the Year. They have experienced a 30% increase in client contracts over the past year alone and are seeing a surge in demand for its cloud-based solutions, particularly from financial institutions. So, fintech, a new buzzword we are starting to hear a lot more of, thanks to companies like Finergo, is a portmanteau of the terms finance and technology and refers to any business that uses technology to enhance or automate financial services and processes. The term is a broad and rapidly growing industry serving both consumers and businesses from mobile banking and insurance to cryptocurrency and investment apps. In Ireland, fintech already employs 400 people locally and a further 400 people outside of Ireland, and this is only set to grow. Fintech is changing the world of finance for consumers in a myriad of ways we now use in everyday life. For example, you can now open a bank account over the internet without physically visiting a bank. You can now link this account to your smartphone and use it to monitor your transactions. You can even turn your smartphone into a digital wallet and use it to pay for things using money in your account. It is also rapidly changing the insurance and investment industries. Car insurance providers now sell telematics-based insurance, where your driving is monitored using data collected via your smartphone or a black box fitted in your car. This data can then be used to determine how much you pay for your insurance policy. And in the future, it may be possible to buy insurance on a short-term or pay-as-you-go basis. The possibilities are endless. Advances in technology means consumers can also invest over the internet on an execution-only basis without any face-to-face interaction. In time, you may be able to get automated financial advice or robo-advice with little or no human interaction. This offers consumers speed, convenience, accessibility, and a greater choice of products and services because it can be bought remotely, regardless of location. It may mean cheaper deals as fintech companies may not need to invest money in a physical infrastructure like a branch network, so may be able to pass cheaper deals on to consumers. This year, on the 26th and 27th of April, the Fintech World Forum will take place virtually with over 25 speakers from companies such as Oracle, IBM and Huawei. For the uninitiated, Finergo has developed software that manages the mountains of regulations that came in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. They started out developing solutions for banks to help them with regulatory compliance and managing client data. However, in recent years, have moved past its core offerings into helping clients in areas such as asset and wealth management. They are currently number one provider of digital client lifecycle and regulatory compliance technologies in the world. The company, which is now valued at $800 million, having raised over $160 million to date, has recently denied reports that it has called time on a potential $2 billion or 1.7 billion euro initial public offering in favour of a private sale. It continues to explore going public, something it has long aspired to do. The company recorded a turnover of 78.3 million for the first 12 months up to March 31st of 2020 versus 70 million for the same period a year earlier. Finergo are forecasting revenues of around 95 million euro for the year to end March 2021. And in the meantime, he feels there's more business out there to secure. One key way that Finergo aims to grow in the years ahead is through its acquisitions. In 2017, Mark said he wanted his business to be mentioned in the same breath as Irish multinationals such as Kerry Group and Glanbia. With this exciting announcement and Finergo's success to date, he's certainly on track to fulfil his goal. Each year, technology seems to make the world more complex for people to understand, so it's only fitting that customer-centric services are going to win. Chris Skinner, the best-selling author of Digital Bank, ValueWeb and Digital Human, who was also the chair of the European Networking Forum and the Financial Services Club, said, "Ignoring technological change in a financial system based upon technology is like a mouse starving to death because someone moved their cheese. The financial institutions and banks can't play hide-and-seek with the technologies for long. It is an inevitable force that is going to take over the market, and those there to ignore it will be swept away by its sheer fury."
Another great success for a Northsider.
Yeah, Finglas man.
Man there.
Great. A lot of stuff, good great stuff comes out of Finglas.
And that ambition to go global. So best of luck to him and to Finergo. Now, Dave, we've a couple of interesting stories to go through. One is about cake, which is something we don't talk an awful lot about here on Nearby Business.
In the first half of the programme today.
We were bakery, yeah. We're covered with cake today.
But legal issues on cakes.
Legal issues on cakes. What, tell us about it.
Well, Marks & Spencer has started legal action against Aldi in an effort to protect its Colin the Caterpillar cake, with the claim that its rival Cuthbert the Caterpillar product infringes its trademark. Now, M&S, which has lodged an intellectual property claim in the UK High Court this week, is arguing that the similarity of Aldi's product leads to consumers to believe that they are the same standard and ride on the coattails, that's a quote, of M&S's reputation with the product. I think the legal term is called passing off there as another product of a similar nature. M&S wants Aldi to remove the product from sale and agree not to sell anything similar. M&S launched Colin the Caterpillar around 30 years ago, and his appearance has been substantially unchanged since around 2004, except for adaptations for Christmas time and Halloween and related products such as Connie the Caterpillar in the future. Now, on a serious note, the product is central to M&S's partnership with the cancer charity Macmillan in the UK, and the retailer has created a Colin product for the annual World's Biggest Coffee Morning fundraising event. So that's pretty serious if that was being brought into play. Yeah. The cake is a sponge and milk chocolate butter cream topped with chocolate sweets and smiling white chocolate face. I'm sure you know it. You probably get it every year for your birthday. M&S has had three trademarks relating to Colin, with the retailer believes means Colin has acquired and retains an enhanced distinctive character and reputation. Now, a spokesman said, "Because we know M&S, the M&S brand is special to our customers and they expect only the very best from us, and love and care goes into every M&S product on our shelves. So we want to protect Colin and Connie and our reputation for freshness, quality, innovation and value." And there ends the ad for them. But you can see where they're going here. So they're in the High Court in London and they're taking an action on that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, the length that people will go to protect their intellectual property, I suppose, as you might call it.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. And I suppose there'd be a few sniggers when the judge and the pray, what is a caterpillar cake? What would matter and all that kind of thing going on? Yeah. You can see the legal argument going back and forth. I'm sure that'll come to an amicable arrangement there. And I suppose this idea of copying goes on all the time, and people probably push the boundaries to get to near where they can, and without actually being exactly the same, say maybe similar colours.
Yeah.
And, the way people would do that in different businesses. So we'll see what happens there.
We'll watch that and see what transpires there. Now, another company who is getting a little bit frustrated with the ability to do business here in Ireland, the Danish home store, and I'm not quite sure how to pronounce this, JYSK, Jysk or Jysk, maybe something like that, Dave?
I was in one of their stores over there in Gulliver's one day, actually, and it's a sort of an IKEA light is how I describe it.
A mini IKEA.
Yeah, it's sort of exactly like that, and it's a nice little shop. There was a queue outside it, obviously, at the times we were in, but it seemed to be being attended fairly well.
Brilliant, yeah. Now, what they're doing is they're appealing to landlords to get in touch with them as they're seeking to expand their footprint here in Ireland. And the company criticised the time it takes to secure the necessary properties here in Ireland compared to other European countries. They're actually saying that they can issue and sign a lease contract within 2 to 4 weeks in many other European countries, whereas here it can take 4 to 6 months in some cases to get all that process through. So their country manager is a guy called Ronnie Tuominen. Sounds like a Danish guy. Mm-hmm. And he says that it's been a very difficult process here in Ireland to acquire the space they need to develop their business. And they're opening 3 new stores this summer in Carlow, in Tralee, and in Cork, in Eastgate Retail Park. And they're looking to achieve the volume of stores here in Ireland and as I said at the start, increase their footprint. And looking for opportunities right around the country, but also here on the north side of Dublin as well. They're looking for opportunities. So maybe if there's any landlords listening, they might take up the opportunity with them. They're a very big company. And what they're looking for in terms of size is 1,300 square metres and maybe the ability to add that by way of mezzanine or extension as well will be considered. So in old money, that's 1,300 square feet roughly. Which is a decent enough size. And they were founded in Denmark in 1979 by Lars Larsen.
Lars Larsen, yeah.
Yeah. And they've expanded to 51 countries, would you believe?
Yeah,
they have 3,000 stores worldwide and they employ, believe it or not, more than 26,000 people. So a very big organisation.
This is a great business because now people want to be at home and they are at home because they have to be, but they're spending a lot of time looking around them and they're looking at their gardens and what's happening. So internal changes and you know, they're taking a lot of pride in their homes. Just look at the television programmes that are on. The most popular TV programmes are cookery programmes and programmes about houses or refurbishment of houses. So we've had people who need to let a new or buy a new house or get a new house, or people who are refurbishing their house. Dermot Bannon has become a superstar.
Yeah,
the glass window,
Home of the
glass
year box, was very popular as well.
Home of the Year, great program, and really well produced, and really nice footage of the houses and the drone footage and stuff like that. So the house has become the centre much more than it was maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, very functional in the way we live, but people are looking at their houses in a different way, and I think these people are probably responsible for that kind of thing. The IKEA and these Linsk.
So, something like that.
More power to them.
Fair play to them. And just very quickly to mention that the Kerry Group says the sale of its 800 million euro dairy arm is off. They're not going to go ahead with it, would you believe, Dave?
Yeah. And was that something that was happening? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, there was a planned 800 million sale of Kerry Group's primary dairy business, and it's off. It's understood a proposal. They were going to sell it to Kerry Co-op. So this is the Kerry global organisation selling to Kerry Co-op. And it's understood a proposal from the Co-op fell short of what the management at Kerry Group were looking for. And the news and the prospect of a third party now coming in to buy the dairy business that was once the heart of the entire Kerry empire is likely to add further strain to the already tense relationship between the farmer-owned co-op and which is still a major shareholder in the stock market-listed Kerry Group. So there's a lot of different Kerrys there and different things happening. But
the old and the new brigade, I'm sure, are there too.
Yeah,
and just finally, also 131 jobs are at risk at PayPal in Dublin and Dundalk. This is up to 130 roles could be lost at PayPal's operations in Dublin and Dundalk, staff have been told. So hopefully that works out for everybody, relocation and all that sort of thing.
Normally expanding. So hopefully it's only a little bit of a blip.
Mm-hmm.
HR questions answered on Nearby Business.
I'm joined now by David Bell from the HR department. Good evening, David.
Evening, Declan.
David, last week when we were chatting about company culture, towards the end of the conversation, we mentioned the whole idea of annual leave and booking annual leave during the COVID times that we're in. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that now this evening. So, I mean, it's very important, obviously, that people take their annual leave. And as business owners and managers, we have a responsibility to ensure that people working for us do take their annual leave as they are entitled to. But it's kind of strange during lockdown and during these times we're in, isn't it? I mean, it feels odd or something.
Yeah, well, I think there's obviously two issues about annual leave, or two points, I suppose, that are, again, the pandemic has highlighted. One is, as you correctly point out, it is important that you know, people do take a break by that during the working day, but obviously take annual leave as and when they require it. Of course, the problem is that because people can't travel, either sticking within their 5K, even if they're bending that, God forbid, they're not going anywhere. They're not necessarily leaving the country largely, unless it's for essential. So, yeah, I mean, it's the balance of making sure that the staff take some leave, but also that that the companies don't end up with staff when the restrictions ease a bit, all wanting to take annual leave at the same time, or having built up significant amount of annual leave that, you know, sometimes they would have taken some by now. And as we approach the summer, definitely companies are trying to juggle that to make sure that they have the staff that they need when things open up. Balance that with against the fact that they want people to take some annual leave to make sure they don't have significant amounts at the end of the annual leave year, whatever that might be.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, as an employer and an employee, I mean, generally annual leave is by agreement of both parties. It's, you know, I think that's normally the way it would work. So, I mean, during this time, I suppose from an employer's point of view, it's one of encouragement, you know, to persuade people maybe to take that leave and maybe have a policy around it. I'm aware of some companies where they're sort of saying at the moment, sort of by this time of the year, just after Easter, where, you know, say maybe a quarter of the leave should be taken. And then by the end of summer, half, you know, maybe half or a little bit more than half, and then and so on through the year. Is that maybe a good way to look at it?
Yeah, I think if you say trying to do it by agreement and trying to put something in place, depending obviously how many staff you have. But, you know, have a look and see. Most people haven't taken any annual leave thus far this year. Again, depending when your annual leave starts. But if you take it as January to December to make it easy, they may not have taken any at this stage apart from the odd day. So I would review the annual leave entitlements that are there for the staff that are working and have got them. And then I would try and put some plan in place, as I said, to balance the need for them to have taken annual leave, the requirements for the business, and also to avoid having significant amounts of annual leave accrued. Technically, under the legislation, you're absolutely right. It is generally the way it works is that the staff member applies for annual leave over a certain time. Sometimes if it's over maybe 2 weeks or 10 days, they have to apply a bit earlier, or it's not guaranteed. But by and large, most people do it that way. Under the legislation, you can actually determine when someone should take annual leave by giving them a month's notice. And some people did that and are doing that. But again, it's still being done in a relatively consultative manner. It's not necessarily forcing people. And we would, you know, obviously, in these situations, everyone is trying to be fair. And maybe that is a last resort. But I think first and foremost, they should try and get some agreement across the board on people taking annual leave at some stage coming up.
Yeah, so it's that encouragement versus the using the forceful hand, I suppose. Is there any alternative? I mean, in the law or in policies that you're aware of, I mean, is there any alternative where companies can say, well, look, you know, we're not in the position to let you take your leave, or you're not in the position to take your leave, or whatever way it might be, and maybe pay people or buy back the holidays? How does that work?
Yeah, it is a sort of a slightly strange thing over here. Technically speaking, so if you take what most people have as potentially a standard 20 days or 4 working weeks, if they're full time, that would be 20 days. If it's, you know, 4 working weeks, could be 12 days if you only work 3 days a week, for example. So by and large, those annual leave days are fairly untouchable in terms of buying them. The only time that would ever come possibly is if someone left employment and an accrued annual leave untaken, you would be able to pay them in lieu of that annual leave. But under the normal course of events, it's not really recommended to try and pay someone in lieu of annual leave. The other, what possibly is, if someone has more than their annual entitlement under the statute, some people might have 23 days or 24 days.
Yeah.
Once you have allowed them those 4 working weeks or those 20 days, I think there you could, because that's outside the legislation. So there could be people who have got more than their statutory entitlement, and you could potentially pay them in lieu of those holidays to reduce the amount down. If people have untaken leave, which I suppose is the big concern, you can postpone that as an employer by agreement, but it generally has to be taken within, you know, the first 4 months of the following leave year. So it's not kicked down the road forever. And then maybe you're just adding to next year's problem if you do that. But at least, you know, you could say to someone, if they've got some time left coming and it's busy for someone, maybe look, fingers crossed, if it comes towards the end of the year, let's all pray that Christmas will be as busy and no one will be taking holidays or working.
Yeah.
But then perhaps you could say, well, look, maybe if, you know, I'll allow you to carry over those 4 or 5 days, but you do need to take them in the first quarter of 2022 or something of that nature. So, the legislation is quite strict about that. There are opportunities to do it, as I said, if people have more than their statutory entitlement. But I don't know when they're going to change that, because the particular challenges that are faced this year, maybe people might be a bit more, employees might be a bit more amenable to something like that, and whether they would, you know, make a complaint or whatever. I'm not suggesting people break the law, but there might be some wriggle room there because of the nature of what we have.
Sure, yeah. And it is, as an employer, it's an area that's tricky, and you do need to know exactly what you're dealing with here. And I suppose it would be important to get some professional advice from someone like yourself when it comes to this area as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, it is tricky. And if everyone agrees it to an extent, that makes it easier. But certainly if there's anything that's going to be forced or implemented, definitely I would check before I make any of those changes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, when you see it from the employee's point of view as well, I mean, there's nowhere to go. As you said, it's, you know, we're all within the 5K. We're hopefully all going well. We're now into a new regime of within our county. So maybe we can go a little bit further now. But, you know, it's going to be challenging, you know, to from an employee point of view, to be fair, to really figure out what to do with the leave as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is the big problem. So if you're asking staff to take time off, it has to be more coming at it from a possible health and safety situation, that they haven't had annual leave for some time, that they're working. The nature of the work is tricky, as we've discussed before in the past. And therefore, it would be, you know, that is an angle a lot of people are looking at, that it is important from a health and safety perspective, that even if it's sitting at home in your garden or doing your garden or bringing your kids to school or whatever it is that you do, that you do take some time. I can't see too many people taking 2 weeks holidays or 3 weeks holidays at this time, but certainly maybe some days just to try and reduce. So when we do go into the summer and maybe the country opens up a bit, that people will have some holidays left, but not, you know, as I said, not the full amount, the full quota, because that could cause serious difficulties for people.
Yeah, indeed it could, and it is a challenge. Well, hopefully, as you say, there's brighter days ahead. We keep getting told there's brighter days ahead, so hopefully there is, and hopefully this won't be a problem that's around next year. We hoped that last year, but we'll I think say it with a little more confidence this year, and hopefully the summer will give people that opportunity to get a bit of a break as well, rather than, you know, get away and change the scenery, rather than just that break. So thanks a million again, David, for that comprehensive look at annual leave and how to deal with that during these difficult times that we're still in, and as I said, hopefully coming out of it. So thanks a million.
Thanks, Declan.
AOB on Nearby Business.
So, Dave, just time to squeeze in some any other business this evening. And the first story you have is about the Mehel Tourism event. Taking place online went ahead this week.
Yeah, looking forward to maybe brighter days ahead. Up to 500 tourism businesses pitched to buyers from 19 countries during the last few days as Ireland looks to reopen the country to international visitors in the aftermath of the pandemic. Now, in its 46th year, the event known as Mehel is regarded as the most important annual event for the tourism industry and takes on a renewed importance this year with the rollout of vaccines paving the way to a return to international tourism in the years ahead. 216 buyers from all parts of the world took part in the event over the last few days, which is said by Bord Fodge to be on par with previous years. Now, each of the buyers represent tens of thousands of possible customers, and the opportunity to influence their travel itineraries for 2022 is invaluable, the Tourism Development Authority said in a statement announcing the event, which is organised in conjunction with Tourism Ireland.
Brilliant. What a great event and great optimism, I'm sure, with all the operators there for the future as well. Now, yeah. The second piece of any other business is about the fact that some construction has recommenced on Monday there, gone.
Yeah, the construction industry has returned to residential building sites, eager to make up for the months of lost ground due to the pandemic once again. The government allowed the activity to resume on Monday for residential as well as early learning and childcare projects as part of the first phase of lockdown easing following more than 3 months in level five lockdown. The Construction Industry Federation welcomed the reopening of certain sites but maintained its call for the remainder of the sector to be allowed to operate as soon as possible.
Yeah, and it looks like that'll be early May, looking at the most recent information from government that it will be before all construction back, it will be early May. So hopefully it will, because construction's a great driver of the economy, as we know.
Yeah, a lot of jobs there, a lot of employment, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Dave, well, that's it, would you believe, for this week's edition of Nearby Business. Thanks a million to all our contributors this evening. We'll both be back at the same time next week, live here next Thursday at 6 p.m.
And if you'd like to get involved in the programme or contribute in any way, we'd love to hear from you on our Twitter page at nearby_business, hashtag localbiz.
So for me, Declan Ralph.
And me, Dave Daly.
See you soon on the radio. Bye for now.
Thanks for
listening. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.